Shall we take a men's little moment?
All right. Let's go back for a moment to your sabbatical in Denmark, because you did publish two papers out of that. You'd already told me about how much absorption spectra is being measured there.
That's right.
Did you introduce in the mechanisms when you were there?
Well, yes. In fact, one of the papers that I published there was with Arthur Adamson.
That was my next...
Adamson and his family happened to be there just at the same time, unbeknown to me. And Dave Hume, who is an analytical chemist at MIT, and right. his family happened to. So the three of us showed up with Yannick Bier that same year for a year's leave of absence, and it was kind of nice, particularly for the wives, the spouses, and families, that they got together and so forth and could keep in touch. But Arthur and I, Dave did some writing. He didn't do any experimental work. But Arthur and I were in this same laboratory. That is a laboratory that was used even by S.M. Jorgensen, who was really the pioneer of making these metal complexes.
Oh, he's in the dedication of your book.
In the dedication of the book. I have samples, if you're interested in seeing them, that are a century old. Arthur was interested, as a physical chemist that he is, in particularly electron transfer type reactions that Henry Cobbe was doing and so forth. But he also pitched in and did a piece of work with me in connection with this conjugate base mechanism. One thing that you needed to know was that the hydrogen-deuterium exchange We got there. He had his white lab coat on with his assistant with her white lab coat on, and they wouldn't let us touch the apparatus. They said, "Oh no, it's too much trouble. We'd have to teach you how to do it. This, that, and the other. You give us the solutions and so forth, and we'll actually do experiments." So here was the director of this fancy lab, internationally known guy in bioinorganic physical chemistry. Lindstrom Long, who was that day at least being our assistant, and he was making the measurements, and he was also a delightful person who had numerous stories to tell. So he was telling jokes all day, had a terrific sense of humor. So Arthur and I did publish jointly that paper, which was a definitive paper. It was needed. Somebody had to do that experiment, and we did it.
How did you decide on going there?
Well, as a coordination chemist, I wanted to go someplace, and at that time, it had become known that people were measuring stability constants, stepwise stability constants of metal complexes, and that this was a fashionable thing to do in this country. Fernelius, for example, at Penn State at that time had a group of people that came with a bunch of pH meters measuring all these things and so forth. And the person, and I knew from reading literature that the person that had really done the seminal work on this was Yannick Brehm. And I just decided that, well, here's a coordination chemist who has done something that seems to be very timely and significant. And in correspondence with him, I arranged to go there. Had no other reason. And it turned out to be a very delightful year because even before we went, I guess the announcement that I'd gotten a Guggenheim Fellowship or something showed up in the campus paper or someplace. And one of the graduate students came around and said, look, my girlfriend lives in Copenhagen, and if you need any help with housing or something, I can write to her. And he did. And she put an ad in the Politiken, the local paper, you know. And not long afterwards, we had arranged to move into this house, a nice small house, a nice residential area built right after the war with people our age, with children. Our two children were 6 and 4 at the time, of the same age. And they were, one was a crystallographer and one was a physicist, I think, at the university. And they were going to be on leave for a year. I guess one was at MIT and one was at Harvard. And they were delighted to have us show up just at the time that they left. So they left all the linens and all the dishes and everything in their house. And the neighbors were just waiting for us with open arms because they all knew enough English and they wanted to.
It was, I guess, shortly after that you talked earlier about this group of graduate students that you had who were so productive, and I wonder whether we could talk a little more about some of them. Harry Gray, of course, being, as you said,
sure.
I think the word you used was the most notorious.
Well, that's the way it's turned out, I think. he's certainly done exceedingly well, and he's been very kind to Northwestern and to me and Ralph, of course. Yeah.
What was he like as a graduate student?
I think he was no different as a graduate student. He arrived here from Western Kentucky. And, you know, he wasn't as polished as he is now and wasn't as mature by any means. We used to tease him about not even having shoes and coming here in his bare feet and so forth. But he was a very dynamic graduate student. He got involved not only in his own research, but through talking to other graduate students, he would sometimes get involved in some things that they were doing as well. Not necessarily just in my group and persons groups, but for example, Carol King, an organic chemist, was making some sulfur compounds, and the guy that was doing this was a friend of Harry's, I guess, and Harry said, "Well, yeah, we ought to make some metal complexes of those sulfur ligand atoms," and they made metal complexes, and they published a paper, you know, and so forth. I guess King's name was on it, but certainly our names were not. And so Harry was that kind of a guy. He was a real winner. He didn't like to lose. He liked to keep things moving ahead, and. In fact, it was interesting because it was just at the time that Joe Chatt, who was an outstanding organometallic chemist, should have shared the Nobel Prize with Fisher and Wilkinson, in my opinion anyway, had a person by the name of Bernard Shaw, who's done real well at Leeds, as a graduate student. I had Harry Gray here as a graduate student, and Chet was making these platinum organometallic type compounds, and Harry Gray was measuring kinetics and substitution reactions by conductivity methods and so forth. And Chet and I, at one of these international conferences on coordination chemistry, got together on this. And I said, well, if you send us the compounds, we'll do the experiments. And he said, okay. When he got back, he got Bernard Shaw to bottle up some of these samples and send them, and Harry would do the experiments. And we'd send the results back and ask for more compounds. And I didn't realize that this was happening, and I'm sure it's just a Chat's way of making a good story. And one of these things where he contributed to the 100th volume of Journal of Organometallic Chemistry or something, a general article, a fun kind of summary paper. He pointed out that Bernard Shaw, who was making, that he and I had this good arrangement going, because Shaw couldn't make the compounds fast enough, from saying, oh, how fast these guys are doing the kinetics. And Harry Gray was saying, gee, I can't keep up with this guy Shaw, who's making these compounds so fast. So Chet was explaining this as how we'd conned them into thinking that they had to work harder, you know, to make more compounds, or work faster to get more kinetics done, because the compounds are coming. And as a result, we got this big long paper on the trans effect and everything else. But Angelisi was very good, and he was not Harry Gray. There's only one Harry Gray, and Andy Wojcicki was outstanding, and so forth. It was just at a time when an awful lot of very good people showed up here wanting to do graduate work in inorganic chemistry. And that's understandable, because if you think back even at that time, there weren't all that many departments that had exciting things going research-wise in inorganic chemistry. Inorganic chemistry in most departments, even some of the very better departments, was just teaching general chemistry, more or less. And so after you thought of half a dozen or fewer even, that was it. And we happened to be among those. In fact, probably at that point, with the work that Ralph and I was doing, the book and everything else, we were not only among them, we were probably right at the top of all of them. So we really did have access to good graduate students in inorganic chemistry. We still do. The whole precedence that was established then in inorganic still pertains, and we still have access. But now, of course, there's lots of good inorganic chemistry going on in a lot of different places, so we're competing with a lot more places. But that wasn't true then. And it was also true that these people that came at that time, if they were interested in an academic position, they had multiple offers of very good places, because in those days, when universities were expanding and they had an opportunity to add an additional spot, they would look at their existing faculty. They had quite a few organic chemists, also quite a few physical, maybe an analytical or two thrown in. But a lot of places didn't have a single inorganic chemist, so they were all really writing to us like mad, wanting to hire inorganic chemists. And fortunately, we had some, and we had some good ones, and they turned out to go out and do well for themselves, and as a result, also reflect well on the department, naturally.
Of course, what's happened, isn't it, that you created your own competition.
Well, that's right. That's what's happened now. But we managed to keep up. I'm pleased to say that the department and the university here has had enough foresight to allow the inorganic group here on different occasions to really make a strong enough pitch for the fact that we've got a good, strong thing, and let's keep it competitive. And I think even now, we are certainly having to compete with a lot more places, but our department is still ranked among the better departments. For example, in 69-70, when I was asked to do my tour of duty as a chairman, at that time it was a 5-year chairmanship rotating, and I said, oh God, I can't do it for 5 years. I may not enjoy it, I may not do it well, let's do it for 3. Well, they reluctantly agreed. I said, let's do it for 3, and if I do well and you people want me, you can try to, maybe we can do it for 3 more. That'll be 6 instead of 5, and so we went along on that. And then the other demand that I had before I took it was, look, we still get a lot of inorganic chemists. This was in 69, and if I'm going to be full-time chairman, really, I'm not going to have all that much time to take on additional students and take care of them. So we really have to have a young inorganic chemist as an additional spot. Well, the department, of course, agreed. They didn't hesitate. But then it was a time when you had to convince the College of Arts and Sciences University that they should add an additional spot, because they were, in some cases, not even taking care of attrition, you know, and so forth. So, they finally did. I said, well, it's either that or I don't take on the chairmanship, because we do get inorganic chemists, and I feel obligated to make sure that that's covered before I do anything else. So it turned out that spot came along rather late in the day, and I made a bunch of phone calls, and one of the guys I called was F. Albert Cotton. He was still at MIT. And he said, oh God, we got just the guy. He's done so much already. He could leave tomorrow and so forth, but he doesn't want to get his degree right away because of the Vietnam War, and as soon as you get your degree, you're susceptible. And if you guys are flexible and can hang in there for a while, then he might, it would work out. But it turned out to be Tobin Marks. Tobin Marks is just a world beater, you know. He's here now and has done such a fabulous thing, amount of inorganic chemistry and so forth. So we went out and we got Ibers and we from Brookhaven. We got Tobin Marks, and of course we had Schreiber, and we've always been able to add people and add good people and maintain our strength. If anything, our strength is even improved. It's improved, but it's improved along with the others having improved, so it's certainly more competitive now.
Coming back to that group again, you mentioned that Harry Gray came from Western Kentucky. Did the others come from small college undergraduate backgrounds?
Yeah. Andy Wachege came from Brown University, which wasn't a small school, I guess. Angelisi came from St. Olaf. Burmeister came from F&M, and so forth. We get, as is true of all places, we get an awful lot of our people from good liberal arts colleges. As you well know, they do a damn sight better job of undergraduate teaching than we do at the universities, and they really get people motivated in the direction of chemistry and take, again, a personal, professional interest in making sure that these people who are qualified and interested and want to go on do have an opportunity to go. And so that's where these people were from. It's always a bit of a mixture, but by and large, it's from liberal arts colleges. We have so many of them also here in the Midwest.
Oh, yeah. How does your, jumping way ahead here, but how does your undergraduate major population compare to your graduate student population? It's a number of large universities don't produce that many undergraduate majors.
We're no different than any place else. No, I think that we are suffering much like every place else. In fact, at the moment, it's almost a little embarrassing, you know, that you start out, as I tell my colleagues, they don't like to hear me say this, But it is absolutely true. It's even more so at big state schools. But at our place, we start out with about 800 or so freshmen taking either honors course or whatever, taking beginning chemistry. We're lucky to end up with four or five. It's a good year if we have six the chem majors going on to do graduate work in chemistry. We could end up with two or three only. And as I point out to them, God damn it, if you start out with 800, and if you even just intentionally try to turn people off, turn them away from chemistry, you couldn't be more efficient and effective than we are. And here we are telling ourselves that we're just trying to do the opposite. We're trying to get them all fired up and go into chemistry. So I don't know. We must all be doing something wrong. I mean, this is not just Northwestern. I think it's across the country in the universities. I think liberal arts colleges are still doing what needs to be done and doing it well.
Well, you made the comment earlier in your own experience that you certainly had the attention of the four horsemen.
That's right.
Who cared about you, I'm sure, a lot more than anyone here could begin to worry about. And that's where the motivation comes from, as you said. And I had the same experience.
I'm sure of it, yeah. You know, graduate programs in science and engineering at the moment, if it weren't for foreign students, would be really scraping the bottom of the barrel. I mean, in our department, we still have an awful lot of non-foreign students, but we do have several Asians and several foreign students. But if you look in all of Tech, this is an engineering building, number of foreign students is beginning to exceed 50% in some of these departments, and even some of the faculty, several of the faculty are beginning to be foreign rather than Americans. And I don't know, I mean, you know, it's talked about a lot, and there are all sorts of things that are said, but it really hasn't been possible to turn this around at the moment. It's pretty bad shape.
Well, with a little bit, I do want to get to your term with ACS and a lot of things that happened in those years, too, because you had some very strong views on certain subjects, and I want to talk about that.
Sure, okay.
Let's sort of move ahead a little bit through my notes. Your work continued on the Carbon Hills for a long time, a number of people, but then you also made an Italian connection somewhere along the line. And how did that come about?
Well, that came about because my name ends in O, I guess, for one reason. And I've always felt, you know, that connection. I say I learned how to speak this peasant dialect of Italian before I learned how to speak English, even. And lived in this little mining community where you could go day in and day out, and all the people there were foreigners, and many of them were Italians. Anyway, in terms of chemistry, there were two or three Italians that were publishing in coordination chemistry, the kind of chemistry that I was doing. And one in particular, Professor Sacconi, Luigi Sacconi. He was not professor at the time, and his first professorship was actually at Palermo. I can tell you a lot of stories about Sacconi, but I won't bore you with the details. But in any case, his English wasn't all that good. And so on this one occasion in 55, when Mary and I drove around Europe, we went to Italy. I still have second and third cousins, you know, and so forth. We visited the cousins in northern Italy, and my Italian was perfect. I could speak Piemontese with them, and they understood me, and I understood them. But then we took off, and we went to the universities. in Milan, Malatesta was an outstanding, you know, Jani Kemmes, Croato at Padua, and Sacconi at Florence, and Cagliotti at Rome. So we purposely went to these places as tourists, and they didn't know I was coming. And when we got there, I'd get on the phone and call them up, and if they were in town, why, they would immediately drop everything and come and look after me. And the one thing that Sacconi really wanted to warm up in 55 to me for was that he was beginning to want to publish his papers in English journals, the Journal of Chemical Society, Royal Society of London, or Journal of American Chemical Society. He was fed up with the Gazzetta, the Italian thing that nobody would read. He said, I do all this good work and I put it in the Gazzetta, nobody reads it. So he wanted to publish it in English. And he conned me into helping him write these papers in English. And so he would send me a manuscript and I would edit it, you know, not change the chemistry, but change the words and put it in better English. And then he would submit these, and he got an awful lot of visibility because he started publishing his papers in English, in the English journals. And so that was really the thing that established an Italian connection, because he was very influential. But then the big power in inorganic chemistry back in the 60s was Vincenzo Cagliotti, who was capo della mafia of inorganic chemistry in Rome. And even Sacconi and Malatesta and all these other guys would come there, and he would dole out whatever monies that the Italian NSF equivalent, you know, Congresso Nazionale di Research has to them, and they would decide on who should be promoted to professorships and so forth. But Cagliotti was the man. And on this one occasion that Sacconi had set up a lecture tour throughout Italy for me, Sacconi felt like it should, Cagliotti felt like it probably should not have been Sacconi that had done this, it should have been Cagliotti that had done this. But in any case, Cagliotti got me off to the side. Cagliotti didn't speak any English, but my Italian was good enough so we could communicate. And he said, now the next time you go on leave and so forth, I want you to come here and this, that, and the other. And made it such a nice offer that we did go there in 61, 62. By that time, we had two additional children, so my four, and my wife and myself. And that's when we lived in the suburb. He had arranged for us to stay in this big villa, you know, in Monte Sacro outside of Rome. But there are no English-speaking people there, even in the shops. So Mary and the kids had a little bit of a rough time. I used to enjoy it because my Italian's good enough that I could at least communicate. People recognize right away I'm not Italian, but we could communicate. But then Cagliotti, because of our being there all year and because of my knowing a lot of coordination chemists who he had invited to come, especially because I was there during the year, and everything, why, he saw to it that I got into the Lincea, the Academy of Sciences, which is the oldest academy of science in existence, founded by Galileo. And likewise, in Turin, where Turin is the northern part of Italy, where they were doing some carbonyl work at the same time we were, and they knew about our work, and I visited them, and we exchanged ideas and so forth. A few years ago, they gave me an honorary degree and so forth. And so they've been more than kind, and I have always invitations to go to Italy, and I never turn them down.